Blog Talk Radio.
From the Boomer and the Babe studio at the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's time for Exploring Faith with John Mayer and Pete Peters. Join them as they explore the role of faith in today's world. How does it play a role in business, politics, lifestyles, families, and individuals? Now here are John Mayer and Pete Peters with today's guest.
And it is John Mayer and Pete Peters, another edition of Exploring Faith. And we want to make sure that everybody realizes we're doing this on a Wednesday. This is the first Wednesday in May. It's May 2nd, 2012, broadcasting from our studios at the Feeding Arizona Complex in Youngtown, Arizona, which is also the home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. And I'm Pete Peters, and my co-host is John Mayer, and we have a guest in the studio. So we're going to let John introduce the guest. This is somebody we've had on the show today. But we're going to be taking a look at a little bit more in depth on what this gentleman does. So, John, why don't you take it away and introduce our guest.
Great. Thank you, Pete. Our guest today is my good friend Chuck Fitzgerald, and he is with us today for the second time, which is very few people are here for the second time. But Chuck is in that elite group, and Chuck and I had met in Leadership West and have shared quite a bit since then, over those few years since then. And Chuck is currently serving in DES as the Director of the Office of Faith and Community.
That's right.
All right.
Let me interrupt real quickly. You have mentioned Community West or whatever that
Leadership
is. Leadership
West.
Yeah. West. For the sake of discussion, just take 3 minutes, if you know, two minutes if you can, and tell us what Leadership West is, where you guys met. And that may have some bearing on all of this.
Okay, we can do that. Leadership West is an organization in the West Valley which has the purpose of raising up and releasing leaders for different leadership kinds of positions in different areas throughout the West Valley, whether it's in education or nonprofit or government, business. I'm sure I left something out, but that's what it is. So every year what they do is recruit a class, so people would apply. The class will spend a year going through some fairly heavy content kinds of things on once a month, issue days. I think they call them something else now, but when we were in it, it was issue days. And so there'd be a presentation on government, presentation on the environment, you know, whatever it is, having to do with the West Valley. And then in between that, there'd be field trips, which I think they call that something else too now. I mean, and you'd go to different things around the West Valley and check them out, see them. Somebody be there and tell you all about it, like Luke Air Force Base or whatever. And then there'd be a small group, and that's you'd be in a small group which would do a project. You come up with the project, you name your own group and all that, so that you have some teamwork also. So you're getting a lot of content, and then you're seeing a lot of things, and then you're having some peer experience too. Then after that, you spend a year organizing a good bit of that for the next class or serving on some of the committees or something for 2 years. And that's the idea.
So it's about building leadership, building camaraderie, working together in the West Valley here in Phoenix, West Valley, and doing good work.
Yes.
All involved in one.
That's
Thanks.
What it's about.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to get that on the record that's what that is.
Yeah, that's okay. Chuck, do you want to add any... What should we say? Depth to that description.
Well, I can. First, I'll say I work for the state, and I wouldn't work for the state if it had not been for Leadership West.
Yeah.
I made connections through our time in that class together that eventually shifted my career away from what I was doing in the private sector to what I now call public service. And so it's about connections. It really is. You can do more if you're connected in with the right circles of folks, and that's a lot of what it's about.
Right.
So,
yeah.
LeadershipWest.org.
Right. Yeah. It was very helpful to me, too. I didn't change careers, obviously, as a result, but I entered Leadership West shortly after moving here. I had been here maybe 6 months. And the Southwest was a complete mystery to me, you know, coming from the East Coast. And that really helped me get some handles and understand what the culture here is like.
Yeah. So it's a good way to get involved and get connected to your community and find out what's going on in the area and so on and so forth. So.
And if you are a leader, and the idea is to bring people that show leadership capabilities into the program, it allows you to ratchet that up, add velocity to that, so that you can make greater impact in whichever area you care about,
yeah.
whether it's education or government or whatever it might be.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
You got it, Pete.
Are we done? No.
Been nice having you, Chuck.
Well, you know, John, something that you mentioned, and thanks for the introduction, is this is my second time here, and I think that's because I didn't get it right the first time, so I had to come back, and I have to keep coming back till I get this right. So that's what I heard anyhow. So I'm excited to be here.
That raises a question. Maybe you know the answer to this, Pete. Is there a right that you can get here?
Oh, anything you say is right
okay.
here.
There we go.
Well,
in deference to being left.
Okay,
oh,
there you go. All right. So we won't go there.
We better. Hey, we got some charts and stuff here to talk about.
So
let's talk about those charts. Talk about what Chuck's doing now.
Okay. Well, thank you. So, John, you mentioned Office of Faith and Community. That's fairly new at DES.
Yes.
I've been there about 4.5 years. In fact, August will be 5. And just since last September. What I do at the agency has been elevated into what we call the director's office, Director Clarence Carter. And it's this idea of how do we as an agency and as programs, because our agency's set up into programs, how do we as an agency engage the community in a meaningful way, especially when that piece of the community is not being paid by the state to do the work. So the state's very good at managing their programs. There's lots of contractors around the state that manage all the different programs, whether it's the hunger program or refugee resettlement or aging and disability type program. Whatever the programs are, they're very good. You know, DES is very good at managing those through a contractor network. What they aren't necessarily as good at is how do you manage relationships with people and organizations who aren't in that contractor network.
Yeah.
An example would be, a real simple example might be a food bank at a church. A food bank at a church is serving families that are hungry, just like the state's hunger relief program is. So shouldn't that church and the government know about each other so that perhaps the resources that are being used in the church example I gave are optimized? There are just things that you just don't know, whatever area it is you're working in. You just don't know why things are the way they are, and sometimes you don't know if you're actually helping or harming when you care for people.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so at least having those connection points so that you can at least talk about it and figure out, is what we're doing harmful or are we really helping? And that allows you then to have confidence when you go forward with serving people, because you know you have the connections, the other connections you need, the connections with the existing systems of care.
Right.
So that's a little bit about what the office is.
That's great. I remember an example when I was serving in Pennsylvania, a group of pastors would get together, and one of the things we always talked about was who came to you to ask for money. And it wasn't so much that we didn't want to repeat a handout. It was that certain people in the county programs, if they receive too much assistance from other sources, would lose the county benefit that they got. And we wanted to make sure that didn't happen to them. And the only way we could do it was doing the kind of thing you're talking about.
Right. Right. So I encourage and foster community groups meeting. That's part of what I do.
Yeah.
But also one-on-one connections between an organization and the systems of care that exist. That system of care could include government, can include nonprofits. It can include other organizations, other churches, businesses that are in the same community doing the same work. So making sure people are connected in the best possible way, and then they can make the decisions on how it is they serve families. And so that's what I do. And I do that out of the director's office of Faith and Community at DES.
That's wonderful.
Which is the Department of Economic Security.
Yes, it is.
How did you get to, you were saying prior to the show when we were having our discussion, that this, your position, has been basically down the hall somewhere and not really well known even amongst DES. How did it come to pass that you have had this elevated status, if you will, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. The fact that it's elevated now is almost as interesting as why it wasn't before. And I'll start there. The reason it wasn't before is because it was a new concept, really, in government of actually working with people that you don't have a contract with, right? That was just a new concept. It was we manage the contracts. There are laws in place. We manage to those laws, all that. Well, this is kind of all outside of that. This is where the needs outpacing us, quite frankly. And so how do we become better stewards of the resources that we have as government, and how do we help those community agencies be better stewards of their resources? And so over time, it went from let's have meetings of contractors around the state, which is where it was when I started roughly 5 years ago, to now those meetings have changed. It's not just the contractors that are in those meetings. It is other people that aren't contractors. And so gradually that's gained some momentum over time. You know, it wasn't thrown on a light switch, but over time what we've seen is collaboration in communities that quite frankly didn't exist before, or it wasn't effective before. And so as our new director came in and was getting the feel of DES, he started in March of 2011. So maybe 6 months into it was apparent to him that we had a lot of things going on in the community, and they could all, in one way or another, kind of be focused back to this effort of community collaboration that I had my fingerprint on. I wasn't the only one doing it, but I had my fingerprint on it. And he said, "This is exactly the right thing for us to do as an agency. Let's bring you into my office and let everybody know that this is part of how we do business now. It's not just with the contractors."
When you were more or less acting, not independently, but certainly on a lesser known level,
right?
Stealthily. When you were operating stealthily, stealthily, did you have more freedom and more ability to form your own processes then? And are you being somewhat more restricted and put in a box now that you're in the office?
Yeah, I would say I'm not being put in a box. There's still a lot of freedom in this. My calendar looks different than it used to look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other things that are placed on my calendar for me, if you will. So I feel like I'm busier with things that I wasn't doing before. But, you know, because the position is in the director's office, it's a little bit like I have permission now to do this. And so it's received just a little bit differently throughout the agency.
Is it scrutinized more?
I think anytime you move up, the target on your back is a little bit larger.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that, but that's okay. I mean,
and it hasn't caused any problems.
No, it hasn't caused any problems. I think it's done just the opposite. It's shown that this is the right work. This is the right thing for us to do. So those are good questions, but I feel very blessed to be where I'm at and to see some of the things that I'm able to influence, like what we're going to talk about here. So,
yeah. Well, let's jump into that. Last week, you and I had a chance to chat for a little bit, and one of the things I remember you mentioning was that in Maricopa County, there are no open foster homes for a child to go into if need be at this point. And that there are some dynamics in the system that contribute to that that situation. So I thought we could talk about that. I think the church can play a role in that. But maybe you could start out by this. What would you say is a good description of a safe child?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. I'd like to put a disclaimer at the beginning of this part of the conversation, if I could. I do not work in the foster care system. We have a division within DES that oversees that. It's the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. There are lots of great people there that can give you the exact definitions and all that sort of. I'm not that person.
Sure.
But what I can tell you is that our role is, as state government is when there's a report of suspected child abuse or neglect, we have to investigate.
Right.
And so abuse and neglect are the two key words that we kind of focus in on. There may be other things that you can say are safe or not safe, but abuse and neglect are the two things that get our attention. So if we have a hotline, if someone was to call the hotline saying, I think there's something going on with this child, we have to look into it. And so we do that.
Yeah.
So as far as the state's concerned, it's abuse and neglect.
I'd like to interject one question here. And I'm just, this comes to my mind periodically because you hear this stuff on the news. Somebody, a parent, is accused of child neglect or abuse. And they're accused of that by the other parent because it's involved in some sort of a custody fight. Do you see an awful lot of that?
That's a good question. I can't tell you specifically what numbers are. I'm sure that does occur, and that's part of the investigation process is to see is the child really being abused and neglected. So there is a process. It's a fairly lengthy process, and there are all sorts of documents on the DES website that talk about it. It's like a flow chart, if you will, of what the process is. So we need to investigate. We need to find out. And sometimes we just need to find out and take whatever the appropriate step is for the next step. So it doesn't mean just because there's a report, the kid's going to get snatched away from their family. That's not that at all. There's an investigation piece. And there's quite a process, and some of it's laid out in statute, and it's a pretty solid thing. You know, what's the severity of it, you know, that sort of thing. And so I'm not an expert on any of that, so I can't really get too much into that.
Right, right. But I guess for our train of thought this morning, at this level, there's a report that's been made, or there's suspected, somebody sees something and there's suspect neglect or abuse. There are people who are required to report that by law, where the weight of the law puts a little more responsibility on them to do that than others. I'm one of them, I know.
If you're an adult in Arizona, you're required to report.
Okay. Okay, but I was thinking...
Oh, like it's not strictly people of the clergy and doctors and stuff like that. It's anybody.
This is a required reporting state.
Yeah.
If you suspect child abuse or neglect and you don't report it, you're guilty of not following that law.
Wow.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yep.
There you go. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Did you?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's interesting because it seems to leave a lot of stuff open to interpretation for people in general to superimpose their own
their own criteria, their
exactly.
own value judgments, all those sort of
exactly.
things.
Exactly.
That's one of the things the hotline works on. You know, the hotline is really the tip of the spear when it comes to that, right?
Yeah.
They have to. And so sometimes the investigation's over at the end of the phone call with the hotline, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But those people are trained on how to handle that and what are the right questions to ask and all that sort of thing. And so you're right. So mandatory reporting state.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there we are.
Then I am very glad that I've never seen anybody do some things to their children.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well,
And that's our role as citizens anyhow, is to really protect those people that can't protect themselves. in this case, we're talking about children.
Sure.
It could be an adult with a disability. I mean, I'm not sure that law applies to anyone, but it definitely applies to children.
Mm-hmm.
There are refugees in our country that are, in many regards, powerless. I mean, they don't necessarily speak the language well. They don't
right.
have transportation. They can't advocate for themselves. We have that with some of our seniors as they're trying to live independently, and things just aren't working out for them. And so there are a lot of populations that I think our charge as citizens of Arizona is to take care of them, you know, to look out for them and to advocate for them. And in this case, we're talking about children and mandatory reporting, but that's kind of what that stems from.
Well, when you stop and think about this state, I mean, people all the time are reporting animal abuse. They better damn well, pardon my Spanish, report child abuse. If you're going to report an animal
yeah.
abuse, you should definitely report a child abuse.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Could you unpack a little bit the current situation as you understand it with foster care?
Yeah. I don't have the exact number. First of all, I'll say there are reports on the DES website. That's azdes.gov. Right on the homepage, you can click on reports, and there's a published report every 6 months that has all sorts of charts and data in it, and you can see a lot of that. I mean, it's open to the public, obviously, and it has all sorts of charts on it that give information of age of children, how many placements have they had, you know, all those sort of things. And so for the actual data, I would suggest going to the report.
Right.
But I can say that there are roughly 12,000 children that are in out-of-home care now. That's how we say that. Some are in foster. Most of those are in foster homes. Some are in group homes. Some are in some sort of situation where they need medical attention, so they're in another type of a placement. So there are roughly 12,000 people or children in the state of Arizona that have been removed from their home because of abuse and neglect. All right. I think when we talked, that's a big number.
That's a huge number.
That's a big number.
Yeah.
When we talked last week, what I mentioned on that particular day, and it may be true today as well,
yeah.
there was not one single foster home available in Maricopa County.
Right.
In Maricopa County, is, you know, 70% of the state population, or 68% or whatever it is. So that's a big portion of this issue. So what that meant is that night when we had that conversation, that night if a child was removed, you know, or that day if a child was removed from their home because of abuse and neglect, they had to be put in a place that wasn't a home, or wasn't a single family home. So they'd have to be put in a group home, or if it was in the middle of the night, they probably didn't have a place where they could be taken immediately, so they had to spend the night in a DES office of some sort.
Yeah.
So that did happen on that night.
Yeah.
And so,
excuse me, they had to be taken to the office of DES, literally through a business office.
Right. There are offices throughout the state that are set up with what are called family rooms, that are just for, you know, if a child has to be removed for their own safety, you know. There's a place where they can at least lay their head down.
It's a bed and a warm meal.
Yeah, it may not be a bed and it may not be a warm meal. It may be a couch and a shower, you know.
Wow.
Right. So, and so that's a problem when
yeah.
you don't have capacity in the system to help a child that needs help that day, or the capacity in the system is not an optimal place. You know, a DES office is not an optimal place. A group home probably isn't an optimal place. But if you don't have foster families, what do you do?
Right.
You need to do something.
Right.
So, I would say the way to say it, in the state of Arizona, we're in a state of emergency for foster families today. The need is going up. You know, and part of that has to do with the economy. Part of it, there are all sorts of things that play into that, but the need is still going up. It's the highest it's ever been in Arizona. There are more children today in out-of-home care than I believe ever in Arizona.
Right.
And foster families, recruiting foster families is not keeping up with that. Foster families, in fact, I believe there was a net loss in foster families the last 6 months that were reported. And that's some of that is because they've decided to adopt the children that were in their home. So
right.
they're no longer available for foster care. They don't feel that they can do that, so they end that. They adopt the children they've had placed in their home, which is a good thing. But they're not available as a foster home anymore. So the financial pressures on foster families, there are lots of issues that play into that. So the foster family number has actually gone down while the need has gone up. And that's kind of, that's in general, that's the state we're in right now.
Yeah.
What does it take to be, generally speaking, I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but what does it take to be a foster family or a foster parent? What are some things that a person has to prove or whatever the case may be? That's number one. And then I've got another one, a follow-up to that. I'll just give it to you right now, and that is once a child is taken out of their regular home, they're placed with a foster family, foster parents, how often do they get to go back to their regular home, and is it always, is the problem that took them out always corrected when they go back?
Yeah, that's a great question. The other one was great, too. But
yeah.
Answer them in any order you
so
like.
So what was the first one again?
Well, the first one, what does it take to be a foster parent? What do you have to do?
Okay. On the there's a website. It's called azkidsneedyou.gov. So azkids.
Okay.
KIDSNEED and the letter U. azkidsneedyou.gov. That tells you everything you need to know about that. But in general, first of all, you have to raise your hand and say, we want to do it. And so there's a background check, you know, fingerprints and that sort of thing. There's a training class that is spread over a period of weeks that needs to be completed. And it talks about everything from behavioral issues with the children to, you know, how to care for them, what's expected. The bottom line is, when the state removes a child from their birth family, let's call it, the state's going to be pretty picky in who they can leave those children with now, because now it's the state's child, right? And so we want to be sure that wherever we put that child, it's a good place to be. So there's the background check, there's the training, but then there's something called home studies, where it's a series of visits to the home to make sure it's prepared, you know, like pools have fence, cabinets have locks, guns are locked up, you know, all the things that you would think would be needed. And it's quite a process. And for some people, it's onerous. It's like, you know, we don't want to do that. You know, that's just too much. But for other people, they understand that the state wants to make sure that we place a child, the child's placed in a safe place. And so
those people have to be pretty dedicated folks.
Yeah, this is not an emotional buy.
Right.
I guess is the right way to say that.
Yeah, sure. Now, are there from DES, are there restrictions as to the age of the foster parent, the lifestyle of the foster parent, and any of those types of any stipulations there at all?
No.
None.
No.
As long as you qualify regardless of.
That's right.
Whatever.
Yeah,
okay.
there are single foster parent families, if you will. There are many of them. So the answer is no. So your second question. So here's what happens, and I know this is we're talking here. There's no visual here. I have a little diagram here that the three of us can look at for a second. And in the center diagram, it has a circle, and in there it says a safe child, right? And around that, I have four segments here. One is called the birth family. So how's a child safe in a birth family? A call comes into the hotline. We decide, you know, there's something going on there, but we're going to send somebody out to just take a look, and they find out, well, it doesn't justify removing the child, but parents, here's something you need to work on. Here are some community resources that are available to you. That sort of a conversation takes place. We'll come back and see you later and see how you're doing, kind of thing. And so there's a need to strengthen birth families, all right, whether it's after the phone call is made or whether it's before. It's just this general need where the community can wrap around families, where they can see the families are having a difficult time. And it shows up in some interesting ways. One way it shows up is the small children are left at home alone because mom and dad have to go to work. All right? That's neglect in some cases. You know, when the 6-year-old's watching the 3-year-old and the 18-month-old, that's neglect. Right? So that's a warning sign to neighbors that this family needs help. You know, it should be reported too, but the family needs help. So the community can wrap around the birth family and strengthen the birth family. And sometimes that's done at the nudging of CPS folks. It's like, we're not removing your child now, but there's some issues you need to take care of, and we'll work with you to help you do that. So that's the birth family. The other thing that is on this chart, another one of those things surrounding a safe child, is called foster care. So it's gotten to the point where there's been a crisis, there's been abuse or neglect, the child is removed. What typically happens at that point, and again, it depends on a number of things, but what typically happens is the number one goal is safety of the child. The number two goal is, how do we reunify that child with the family? All right? Because we're not about splitting up families, we're about safe children. So how do we do that? And so through a series of visitations that are supervised, and some of those visitations could happen in the home, some would happen at DES, it depends on the case plan. We would then work with that family so that they would correct whatever needs to be corrected in order to get their child back, or children. It could be sibling groups. It could be 7 kids, right? How do you place 7 kids in a foster care home, right? That's a whole other issue, but that happens. And so there's room for the community to support families even after the child's been removed. How do we get the house up to speed? How do we make sure child care is taken care of? How do they go to anger management classes? Are they sober? Are, you know, all those sort of things can determine whether the birth family will get their child back. And so there's all sorts of supports and case plan steps and all that sort of thing to make that happen. But at some point, you know, in many cases, this isn't going to happen. This child's not going back. It could be because parents are dead. It could be because parents are in prison. It could be they're just not fixing it. So there's kind of a line that's drawn. Once you cross this line, the child's up for adoption. We're not working on reunification anymore. We're working on adoption. And that's another one of these segments I have on this diagram around the safe child, is adoption. So the safe child is always number one. The first is, how do we reunify the child with the birth family? And many cases that works. Most cases that works. But there are cases that don't. So now the child is moving into an adoption plan kind of mode, if you will. So there are lots of opportunities for this visitation piece, but it takes cooperation on the birth family, and it has to fit the case plan, if you will.
Yeah. I notice on your chart one of them is there's independent living. That means is that a case where the child becomes of legal age?
Exactly. And so the fourth segment around this safe child piece is, so let's say that a child that's 12 years old or 15 years old, whatever the age is, has been removed from their home because of abuse or neglect. The reunification isn't going to happen, so those parental rights have been severed. That's a court decision, so the courts decide that, not the CPS worker, right? The parental rights have been severed, so now this child's in the foster care system, is up for adoption, but never gets adopted. And that happens a lot. It's possible for that child then to do what we call age out of the system. And what that means is, when you turn 18, you're an adult, and you get to make the decision if you want to stay in foster care or not. You're an adult. You can decide whatever you want. And many of these children are saying, I'm fed up with all your help.
Yeah.
I don't need any more of that kind of help. I'm out of here. And a lot of these children say it. Well, they're young adults now because they're 18. And so they walk away, in many cases, with virtually nothing. No social capital, very few possessions. They don't have a driver's license. You know, all the things that, you know, so how do they survive? So what is available to them, though, and many refuse this, is up until age 21, there are services available for them to help them with independent living. Education services, health services, there are a variety of things that are available. It's quite an extensive list of things that are available. Not all these aging out kids opt in for that. So they may start when they're 16 and start consuming, if you will, these independent living, I hate using that word, that's utilizing the independent living resources that are out there. So they have a couple years head start, if you will, until the time they're an adult. And then they can decide, do I continue on with this till I'm 21 or do I just say goodbye? And so the idea is that if you've been in the foster care system, your rights have been severed, you've languished in the system because you haven't been adopted, there probably aren't a whole lot of good thoughts going through your head, right? It's just I can't imagine being in that spot, but it happens all the time. Every year in Arizona, there are about 600 children that age out of foster care in Arizona. And 2 years down the road, there are reports and data that show good things don't necessarily happen to them.
Right.
So there's the purpose of this diagram, and again, I apologize for those listening, is that the child's in the center. There are different points where the child can be moved between birth family and some type of foster care or foster care and adoption or foster care to independent living. But in all cases, there are community ways to assist the child in these families that are pretty extensive as well. There's lots of room for the community to play in this. And that's really what I talk about when I go out and when I talk about child safety. That's what I talk about to faith organizations, to businesses, to civic groups, that sort of thing. So,
what's some ways that a church or just any faith community would start navigating this if they wanted to help?
There are a couple ways to do that. That's a great question, John. Again, at azdes.gov, there's lots of information about that sort of thing, and so I would encourage folks to check that out. There's another pretty cool resource that's out there. A couple years ago, Governor Brewer started an initiative called Arizona Serves, and that's at arizonaserves.gov, and I helped to lead that for the governor. And what that is about is that's about kind of how I started this whole conversation of how do we connect the caring community to existing systems of care? How do we do that in a meaningful way so they can engage in a meaningful way? And so one of the things we've done on ArizonaServes.gov, if you go right to that homepage, you'll see a picture on there with little handprints that says Arizona Serves and Children. You click on that, you get a list of ideas on things that you can do, either as an individual or as an organization, to support children around this issue of safety. And so there's a list here, things like finding and supporting foster and adoptive homes, connecting with existing providers, and so on and so forth. How do you wrap around and strengthen families? And so through Arizona Serves, we can connect you with agencies in your community that have programs around all these things, and they're always looking for help. They're looking for mentors for the kids. They're looking for mentors for the families, whether it's birth families or foster families. There's a vast number of things that can be done by someone that's not in the system, someone that's just in the caring community, someone that's in a church. There are lots of things to do. So ArizonaServes.gov is an excellent place to connect and to see what some of the options are and then connect with agencies.
Yeah. Not to be critical of anything about the system, but maybe you could just describe, let's say there's a fellowship in the community, and they say, well, you know, together we want to contribute to this. We want to get involved somehow. Are there some stop signs or some walls they might hit along the way that they need to know before they get in?
Yeah. I would say, yeah, that's my job. You know, if I had to boil my job down into answering one question, it would be that, and that is to be able to somewhat be a translator between this fellowship you're talking about and the system, if you will. It's different languages. They don't necessarily trust each other all the time, right? The system and this fellowship, as you say. And so being a translator and being able to help break down the communication walls between those two groups is the largest obstacle. And so I'll give you a quick example. A church calls and says, we want to adopt a CPS visitation room. All right, this is a room where these supervised visits take place between a child or children in a foster care setting with their birth family. So they both show up at the same time in the same room, and a caseworker or parent aide or someone watches them as they spend time together to make sure they're doing that appropriately, right? Well, they do that in visitation rooms. Some of those rooms look great. They look great like your studio. Others don't look so good. Others have, you know, the battleship gray desk and, you know, a church will step forward and say, we want to adopt the room, and someone in a CPS setting, like a, let's call it a CPS manager, doesn't know anything about this church, doesn't know what their motives are. Why are you coming to me now? I'm busy. And so the conversation never really takes off, right? But I can break that down. I can help with that. I can help vet it, if you will. I can talk to the faith community, the church in the example I'm giving, find out what they're trying to do, how sustainable do you think it might be, what's your real objective here, and all that sort of thing. And I can translate that, and I have access to the people in the CPS office. And I can say, here's the deal. They want to serve you, the CPS manager. That's what they want to serve. They don't want to be in the visitations.
Yeah.
They're not going to be with the children. They want to serve you. What do you need to provide better visitation set up for the families you serve here in this office? And then they start thinking, well, that carpet's awfully dirty, or the wall needs painted, or we don't have anybody to call for diapers, or, you know, and the list goes on and on. Before you know it, there's a relationship between the two, and now that CPS worker has somebody in the community they can call right down the street saying, you know, I could really use some children's books, you know, or stuffed animal, or whatever it is, to help enhance the quality of that visitation setting, or games that the parents can play with their children when they're visiting, that sort of thing. And so that's a program that's going on under Arizona Serves, is how does a faith community adopt a visitation room? And so that's one of the programs that are initiatives that I help to run for the state. So if a church says we want to adopt a visitation room, I can help make that happen.
Yeah.
Do these visitation rooms or foster parents or anything that's anybody that's involved in whatever level they're involved in, are they remunerated in any way?
That's great. In the example of adopting the visitation rooms, no, not at all. And quite frankly, the faith community doesn't want that. That's not they. It's a mission. They just want to go serve, you know. And so that never comes up in that context. Foster parents, however, are. There is a foster care stipend per child per month. And again, that's on the DES website. And so there is, it's not a lot, but there is a little bit of money available to help foster parents with this new family member or group of family members that have come into their home.
Right. Yeah. Last week, when you and I were first talking about this, I remember you talking about a church, example of a church, that had some families interested in becoming foster parents, but some of them couldn't do it, and it was because of a county boundary issue. Could you describe that a little further?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The way foster families have to be licensed in Arizona, all right? Or maybe I use the wrong word, maybe it's certified. I can't remember which one it is, but let's say they have to be licensed, and which means they have to go through this training, they have to do the home study I talked about, all, you know, background checks, all that sort of thing. There are only certain agencies in the state that can license them. All right, so these are contractors, DES contractors, that can license foster families. So these agencies, they are only licensed to license people within certain counties. So if you have, in the example I think I gave you, a church that sits on the boundary between Maricopa and Pinal County, all right, some of the families are in Maricopa, some of the potential families are in Maricopa, some of the potential foster families are in Pinal County, this agency could not license those families in Pinal County because they weren't licensed there. What they could do is they could subcontract to somebody that is licensed in that county. And in many cases, they do. In some cases, it's not practical. Mm-hmm. When you get into the details, there's money involved. There's, you know, Yeah. Those sort of things involved. There's also things involved like what are the value statements that are put forth by the two providers in this case. One is very, very biblically based. That's what they're about. They're a faith-based agency. They've been working with the church to put this message forward, and yet the other one is not. And so now you have families that attend this church that like the message they heard. They like the equally yoked message that they heard from that provider. Now they're being told, oh, you have to go to this provider.
Yeah.
And so that causes a little bit of problems. So we're trying to figure out how do we, is there something we can do as a state to help alleviate some of that?
And I suppose from the point of view of the church, if the leadership understands that's how licensing happens, and some of your people may need to go down a different path than some of the others, they could probably grease those wheels somehow.
Yeah, I would think that they could.
Yeah.
They could.
Maybe even help the one licensing group subcontract to another in the other county in some way, whether it's finances or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me add one more thing to that while Pete's formulating his question here.
Right.
I see one coming.
Oh, my.
And that is, in the example I just gave you, a family in Pinal County says, well, I don't want to go with that agency because we want to pray over every decision we make and the children along with the faith-based agency.
Yeah.
Right? That's part of their ministry, and that's part of what they do. And so it still may not, even though the wheels have been greased, it still may not feel like it's something they want to do.
Right.
So,
right.
And that is the case in some places. And so here we are, shortage of foster families. We need to figure out how do we remove those kind of barriers, and is there something we can do as a state? Maybe there's not, but maybe there is something we can do to help with that, or is it just something that the providers need to figure out amongst themselves?
Yeah. You've got a church that is on the Maricopa County line, on the Maricopa County side of the line from Pinal County.
Mm-hmm.
The family that wants to operate as a foster family via this faith-based organization, the church, lives in Pinal County. Mm-hmm. Why is it, and maybe I'm looking at this, maybe I've missed something, and if I do, I apologize, set me straight. But the family that's in Pinal County, if they are approved as a foster care family in Pinal County, what's the big deal as long as that requalification is the same kind of qualification there is in Maricopa? What's the big deal?
Well, there's a step in there. They can't get qualified in Pinal County unless they go through an agency that's in Pinal County. See what I'm saying?
So it's a county regulation in Pinal County?
No. What they've done is they've raised their hand and said, I'm interested. Now it's time for them to go to the classes to get the background check and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't happen through the one in Maricopa. It has to happen through the one in Pinal.
Why?
That's the way the system's set up. It's not a county thing. It's a state contract issue right now.
Okay. But my question still is, why? And why can't it be changed?
Well,
if they see the difficulty and they understand the difficulty, it seems like all you have to do is flip the light switch on and make it go the other way.
So
I'm asking the question.
Okay.
I may be very naive on this.
I'm going to give the same answer I gave a couple minutes ago, and that is we're looking at ways to do that,
okay,
whether it's something DES can do or not, because there are contracts out there, whether it's something that has to be done at a higher level, through legislation, or whether it's just something the providers can figure out amongst themselves, And there are some things in place where it can be subcontracted through that provider, but that means the agencies have to get along, and there's money that's passed around, and when you start doing that, things, it starts getting complicated.
Sure.
And so we're trying to figure that out.
Is it the adage, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic,
Yes, is it
the adage of follow the money trail?
I don't know if it's that simple, but no, I don't think it's that simple. I think there are agencies that they're all about child safety, don't get me wrong. They're on board with that. But the way they do it and the services they provide, there's a bare minimum, right? But some go above that quite a bit. Some go above another way quite a bit. And they're different. They're just different. And so the families might not like what's happening in Agent A or Agency A versus Agency B.
So it's sort of like saying the Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church, they both believe in Jesus, but one says this and the other one says that, but the common goal is still the same.
Not so sure about that either.
I mean, do you prefer the method of the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church?
Yeah.
I mean, is it can you draw that correlation? Not that it's a problem with the churches, but I'm just saying, can you use that as a correlation?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, you know, there are two pieces here. One piece is, what is the family comfortable with? What program do they want to plug into?
You're talking about the foster family.
The possible foster family.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do they want to get plugged into to get licensed? Which one are they comfortable with? And the second issue is, are the agencies able to work out whatever subcontracting issues need to be worked out? You know, so it's two things. Sometimes the families will just say, "I'm just not doing that."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I can't go to your website and see, do you have a faith statement right on the front page of your website?
Yeah.
I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
And so that's a problem.
Yeah.
We have somebody to raise their hand, and
yeah.
we don't have a way to service them, right, or to help them be of service. And then the other issue is, between the agencies themselves, have they been able to work out business arrangements and philosophies and all? You know, that it's people. People dealing with people, and sometimes that just isn't good.
Doesn't always work out the best.
It doesn't. And even though it's all about child safety, and everybody would say that's their number one goal,
yeah.
is children need to be safe. Yep.
But it's how you get them safe.
Yep. And right now we need more foster families. So anything anybody can do to remove barriers, whether they're real or perceived,
mm-hmm.
as if there's a difference there, you know, remove anything you do to remove barriers, no matter who you are, is a good thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I would think of an excellent thing for a church to do, especially if the leader has some community influence, is to try to open those doors and represent the one who's also called the Spirit of Adoption. It's another name of God, to be representing God as the one who can open all those doors so that no one is alone. That might be a strong motive for some church leadership to be trying to navigate what obviously is a system that's been layered over some generations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're all called, whether we admit it or not, we're all called to be those peacemakers and
yeah.
to really to tear down those communication barriers, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's one of the ways the church can seek the good of the city. And you know, it's such a, are you, well, whatever, I don't want to get too critical here, but seek the good of the city
right.
is a priority higher, perhaps, than some of the other priorities that
that's right.
we articulate. Yeah.
I don't know if you want to go in this direction or not, but I'm going to ask a question. If you don't feel comfortable answering it, just say so. DES has been in the news quite a bit lately. Any number of reasons that I couldn't even enunciate here. And there's also the Sheriff's Department that's been in the news with regard to investigation of cruelty and abuse cases that supposedly have been sitting there and not being investigated. Let's assume for a second, for the sake of my question, that is accurate and that has happened. Is there anything being done to correct that situation?
Yeah. I can't speak specifically to what the sheriff and that's all about, but I can tell you last fall the governor appointed a child safety task force. And if you were to go to the governor's website, you'd see that information right away. And this task force included the county attorney, Director Carter from DES, many people in the community that are child safety advocates. And they put together a list of 64 recommendations to address some of what you're talking about, to address perhaps things that can be improved in the child welfare system. A child safety system. And so all that information is readily available. There's a list of 64 of these things. Some have to do with law enforcement. Some have to do with building community capacity for foster homes. You know, so there, it's a wide variety of different things. And so there are presentations and talking points and all that sort of thing that you can easily get on the governor's website or on the DES website right on the homepage. There's a Child Safety Task Force link right on the home, and you can see the presentations, all the meeting notes and that sort of thing. So there's a lot being done with regards to that. And so that's a general answer to your question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Chuck, we have a few minutes left, and we're not stopping in 30 seconds or anything like that. We have a few minutes left. I'm kind of wondering, what would you say from where you stand and the work that you do to encourage the faith community in Arizona in this area of foster care?
Yeah. Well, a couple things come to mind. I would love to have had that question a couple of days ago. I could have probably had a really really practiced answer for this, but there are two specific things that
okay.
come to mind, John, because I think about it a fair amount. One is that there are lots of things the faith community can do to help. There are just tons of things you can do. And it really, most of it surrounds family issues, strengthening families. We all can tell when there are stressors on families and things just aren't what they should be. So doing that, whether it's parenting classes, financial literacy classes, there's just a variety of things that the faith community can help propagate, if you will, or help to host and deliver and that sort of thing. So those things are all excellent. There are a lot of great examples out there of those sort of things. The second thing that comes to mind is that you don't need permission to help, right?
Right.
You know, don't wait for the letter to come saying you are now commissioned and capable of helping. You are capable of helping. And again, the list that's on ArizonaServes.gov about children talks about things like, you know, how do you, maybe you just call up a foster care agency in your community and say, what do you need? You know, something like that. And so there are just a lot of things that you can do. You can help with adopting and providing visitation rooms in communities like we talked about a little bit before. But you don't need permission. You just need the connections. And so don't be scared to ask for those connections. There are a number of folks that can help with that. I clearly can. I'd be happy to help any organization, anybody that wants to get connected. So I would say that's second. And the third thing is, this issue of foster care today, just because we're in such a dire need of foster families, that message has to come from the pulpit as much as possible. And it doesn't have, you know, whether it's a guest speaker that's in the system, it is a provider that can come and talk, or whether it's just educating yourself as a faith community leader such that you can talk about it. There are people in our community. Just like I said, as an organization, you don't need permission to help.
Right.
There are people in our community that are waiting for permission, too. And sometimes that can come from a faith leader saying, you have permission to do this. Here's how you get connected. Here's what you do.
If you were to, I mean, through the auspices of a church, assuming that you're having regular church services or whatever, you have an audience, and you could bring Chuck Fitzgerald in to speak to your audience. But outside of that realm, when there is no structured organization or group there already, are there ever times or places where you go and speak to other kinds of organizations?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll go speak to a business. I've spoken to service clubs. We've had people speak to HOA groups. You know, so yes, absolutely. And it's not just Chuck. There are lots of people that are very conversant on this topic and can come and bring their expertise and their ask, if you will. Here's what we need. One idea that comes to mind is there's an agency that one of the key parts of their child safety spectrum or continuum, if you will, is mentoring of birth families, you know, and the idea is let's prevent it before the child's removed. Let's fix whatever the problem is in the birth family before it escalates to the point where a child has to be removed. Some things you'll never be able to see. I mean, there's evil in the world and all those sort of things, right? And you're going to need to remove a child. We're going to have to continue to remove children from their homes for their own safety. And the foster care system is, you know, set up to help with that. But what are we doing before that? Mm-hmm. There's a big role for the faith community in that. And there are foster care and adoption agencies, if you will, that are looking for those kind of relationships to help before a crisis happens.
Right. You know, in our service, our baptismal service, where we have provision for baptizing babies, there's parents and godparents. And one of the promises the parents and godparents make together is, will you by your life and witness to all you can to have this child grow into the full stature of Christ? And it, as you were describing, mentors of birth families, godparents who make that promise alongside of birth mothers and fathers, could become mentors in just in all aspects. I mean, to grow into the full stature of Christ, what's left out of that?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in where I worship, it's not so much godparents as it is small group leaders.
Yeah.
Small group leaders, that's part of their first line of ministerial duties, if you will, is to make sure that the people in their small group are living in that way and do have the supports to help them, especially when all these stressors are on their lives.
Yeah.
It was interesting 3 years ago when my youngest granddaughter was born here in over in the Women and Children's Hospital in Tempe. My daughter gave birth, and before she left, she had to watch the movie about shaking baby. There's a movie that's out there about don't shake the baby.
That's right.
And she had to watch that movie. It was so. I mean, it on some level, somehow, these things are in place. Whoever put that in there, I don't know. And if it was DES, thank you. If it wasn't, thank you, whoever it was. But it may have been in response somewhat to the law that we first talked about, that everybody is responsible for reporting and so on and so forth. And it's maybe a way to start the thing. At least I guess if it stops one person from doing something that could be detrimental to that child, then I guess it's worth it.
Yeah. As you say that, something that comes to mind is May 1st started Foster Care Awareness Month.
Right.
Well, April was Prevent Child Abuse Month. And so Never Shake a Baby was one of the themes through that month. Another one of the themes through April was who do you trust with your child? Hmm. And that's what we see in many cases is because a birth parent needs to go to work or needs to run down the store for just a few minutes, it's someone that's left to watch the child that probably isn't the right person to watch that child, whether it's another child, a boyfriend, whatever it may be. And they haven't seen the video, right?
Sure.
Wow.
That sort of thing. And so who do you trust with your child is another campaign that's going on right now.
There is an absolute tragedy that I am personally aware of because it happened on the periphery of my family. And that is my brother-in-law has a nephew that had a child out of wedlock with this woman. And he married a second woman. She would have custody of the child during the day. Turns out the child was terribly, horribly abused and beaten, died. The woman is now spending her life in prison in Michigan.
Unfortunate.
And that kind of a situation, that's the kind of stuff that you just hope that somehow can be avoided. And I don't know if it's a DES issue, if it's a church issue. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what the answer is. But all of these things that you caution against, Chuck, like know who's taking care of your child,
right,
you know, obviously make sense. But sometimes it can make all the sense in the world, and people just don't heed it.
True.
And I think it's the thing about getting them to heed that warning and be mindful of that can be very tough sometimes.
Our director, Clarence Carter, he likes to talk about how the safety nets, you know, which DES is a part of, is about really about supporting people that are economically and socially challenged. The socially challenged is the piece that DES isn't very good at.
Right.
That's the community piece that wraps around this diagram I'm talking about. Is the people when they don't have other options, they leave the child with the wrong person. If they don't have other options, they leave the child unattended. It's in and if people are socially connected, and I would venture to say the three of us are, right? And many of the folks that we hang with are probably very well socially connected. There are many people that aren't, and that really lends itself to these sort of things.
Well, we could get into a whole long political discussion about funds being cut and not having set child care facilities and all that kind of stuff provided, and it sometimes it just seems to land on deaf ears, and I think we have to sometimes reassess what the priorities are. And if people would do that, if governments would do that, we might be able to be in better shape. I hope. I would hope, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if that's the answer either. But it's a thought anyhow.
Well, I'll tell you, the faith community is stepping up in a very large way to serve families. They always have. But now they're doing it in a partnership with government, which is a fairly new thing. And that's just awesome to see. And so I'm very encouraged. I'm very hopeful. And I hope the people listening to this aren't getting depressed listening to this, because there are a lot of good things going on, and I'm very encouraged. We're
well,
all very encouraged by that.
That's great, and it's not our point here to to depress folks over it. I think our point is to point out what has to be corrected and how can you help.
Excellent.
I think that's it.
And with guys like you, Chuck, and in the position you're in, I have a lot of hope because of what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for what your public service.
Well,
it's wonderful.
As I close this show down, Chuck, give us your new title again.
I'm Director of the Office of Faith and Community at DES.
Director of the Office of Faith and Community at DES, Mr. Chuck Fitzgerald.
Absolutely.
And he's been our guest today on the Boomer the Babe Show, Exploring Faith with John Mayer and Pete Peters. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio, where we bring good conversation today. We bring you that conversation with Chuck Fitzgerald. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe Show live every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do more than host this radio program. We also have ebook authors, and they have their own shows. We publish many books, and we have our new Exploring Faith show. We'll be up again on the third Wednesday of the month. And we don't have a guest yet, but we'll have another good one for you, no doubt about that.
Absolutely correct.
And Experience Speaks, online magazine. Go to boomerthebabe.com and sign up for Experience Speaks. It comes free to your inbox every month. Remember to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and have a great day, everybody, and enjoy the weekend if we don't talk to you before then. Take care for now.
Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversations to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.